Hello everyone, this is Bob Zeta, my amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading it together today in digest format, World Radio Online for September 2011. World Radio is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Pikesville, New York, 11801. The editor, Richard Fisher, amateur radio call KI6SN. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Amp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Amp members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Amps may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address lowercase one word handyham@courage.org. There is a website at http://www.handyham.org. On the cover of World Radio Magazine for September 2011, you'll get a picture, literally, of the almost original repeater that started it all in the 1950s. That'll be in Looking West with columnist Bill Pasternak. And also, young speakers blew away the crowd attending the Dayton Youth Forum in May in Dayton, Ohio. We'll talk a bit about that too later on. But first, let's take a look at World Radio Online Newsfront. VE3 and UC. Victor Echo 3, November, Uniform, Zulu. Named new chief of Saturn, Salvation Army Major Richard Shiram, VE3NUZ, has been appointed as the new head of Saturn, the Salvation Army Team Emergency Radio Network. He succeeds Major Pat McPherson, WW9E, who has been director for 23 years and one day after the first SaturnNet was held. The announcement was made by Colonel David Jaffe, the National Chief Secretary of the Salvation Army. McPherson applauded the choice, saying Shiram has been a longtime proponent of Salvation Army Emergency Disaster Services and its Saturn component. He understands well the culture of amateur radio and the Salvation Army, and he has proven expertise in every field of disaster endeavor. That commentary was compliments of CQ Newsroom. Data harvesters bring QRZ.com to a crawl. Users of the QRZ.com call sign database must now be registered and sign in before getting access to any name or address data. Owner Fred Lloyd, AA7BQ, explained in a posting that routine access to the database was being slowed down by a growing number of automated systems trying to harvest massive amounts of data at one time. Registration is free. AM users may access a maximum of 150 call signs per day, not including their own. Non-AM users are limited to 25 lookups per day, and QRZ subscribers will continue to have unlimited access. Thanks to CQ Newsline for that piece. Japan quietly goes no code, beginning in October. Back in the 1950s, Japan became the first country to issue an amateur license that did not require a Morse code exam, the so-called Class 4 license. Now, according to Amateur Radio Newsline, effective October 1, Japan will no longer require code tests for any class of amateur license. After dropping the code requirement for the Class 4, Japan continued to administer code tests for the Class 1 and Class 2 licenses, even as most of the rest of the world ended amateur code test requirements. On an issue about which so many hams have been so passionate for so many decades, a request for comments on the proposed rule change drew only 39 responses. 60-meter privileges widen in Portugal. Portuguese radio amateurs have been allocated an additional frequency at 5 MHz in the 60-meter band, Amateur Radio Newsline reported. The Portuguese telecommunications agency ANACOM has authorized the use of 5288.5 kHz in addition to the already allocated frequencies of 5371.5 kHz and 5403.5 kHz. The three frequencies are available on a secondary non-interference basis. Special 60-meter propagation study permits are being issued to Portuguese radio amateurs for up to a year. That was filed by IARU Region 1 and ARN. Cadets send balloon satellite to the edge of space. Cadets from the U.S. Military Academy's Astronomy and Amateur Radio Clubs used the last day of the 2011 spring semester to launch a balloon satellite to the upper reaches of Earth's atmosphere. Still and video cameras aboard the craft shot photos as it rose to an altitude of more than 85,000 feet and then descended. An automatic packet radio system, APRS, transmitter, allowed students to track the payload throughout the flight and to later recover it. The instruments, still cold from their journey to space, according to a West Point News release. The release also describes the APRIS system as an ad hoc network for ham radio operators that run a nationwide communications utility as a public service. The launch also highlighted inter-service cooperation in the military, as the West Point Group has been collaborating with the Aeronautics Department at the U.S. Air Force Academy. An APRS was developed by Bob Bruninga, called WB4APR, who teaches at the U.S. Naval Academy. We thank CQ Newsline for that bit. The Editor's Log by Richard Fisher, KI6SN. Seeing there are no gigantic, enormous issues on the table this month, it's probably a good time for the old cranial data dump. Several little things to catch up on. Midweek WRO online chats. Well, we gave the Midweek World Radio Online Live online chat session a couple of tries, but it seems staying up late on a school night is just too much for most of our readers. The chats were lively for sure, but more like a bunch of hams sitting around in the living room than at a stadium concert. The Sunday sessions have frequently drawn more than 100 participants to the WRO blog's chat-o-sphere. Wednesday, though, not so many. So for the time being, hearing no objections, we'll schedule upcoming chats for our usual weekend slots, usually the first Sunday of each month. Our next chat will be September 4. A great way to relax over the Labor Day weekend. We'll begin at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 0 UTC, at the usual place. The World Radio Online blog website is http://www.worldradioonline.blogspot.com. Simply click into the Cover in Live chat box when the session is to begin, and you'll be linked to the chat room with lots of your WRO friends. By the way, if you'd like an email reminder about that chat, please register for it using the Cover It Live box on the blog. I hope to see you there. UTC versus Eastern Time. We get email once in a while wondering why WRO doesn't list all activity times in Universal Time Constant, UTC. Good question, and we have a not very good answer. We try to provide both local and UTC times when listed, but in all candor, some slip through the cracks. We've got either Eastern Time or UTC, but not both. We've got to fix that. Why Eastern Time? It was chosen by me as a standard based on the boob test theory. You know the boob test theory? Here's my reasoning. TV networks promoting upcoming programming usually list live broadcast times in two time zones, Eastern and Central. Most of us have figured out how to mentally convert that information to our TV room. In California, for example, 8 p.m. Eastern is 5 p.m. Pacific. Even an arithmetic challenged guy like me can do that. PT equals ET minus 3. Converting to UTC is another matter, though. I get completely lost and have for 46 years as a radio amateur, no matter how hard I try. I even made a cardboard UTC converter wheel once, but managed to get that screwed up as well. So, here's my latest solution. It's an actual website, http://bit.ly/m0gxu6. It's the Time Zone Converter, a free online program that has never let me down. The site is fairly intuitive, and once you get the hang of it, you'll be converting like old man Time himself. Meanwhile, we'll make an extra effort to provide UTC with the Eastern or local time we list in WRO. Now, WRO is on Facebook and Twitter. I suspect most readers know about this, but it bears repeating. WRO is alive and well on both Facebook and Twitter. In addition to the WRO blog, these are great places to get updates on articles that have appeared in the web magazine, as well as reminders about WRO activities, such as our monthly online chats. Follow us on each of these social networking platforms, and we promise to keep you up to date on WRO happenings. And this just in. Speaking of keeping up with the buzz, WRO and our sister magazines, CQ Amateur Radio, Popular Communications, and CQVHF, help feed CQ Communications online amateur radio breaking news site, the CQ Newsroom. It's a beautifully designed, easy-to-read website administered by CQ Communications editorial director Rich Mawson, called W2VU. You'll recognize his name and call sign as editor of CQ Amateur Radio Magazine as well. A veteran newsman, he aggregates amateur radio news from around the world on the site. It's a great place to bookmark and check in on every day. And lastly, your feedback, please. We count on WRO readers to let us know how we're doing. Are you finding our content month to month useful and interesting? Are there areas we're not covering that we should? What pleases or bugs you? Please let us know. Drop me an email too. worldradioonline@gmail.com. Our first feature article is from the Quarter Century Wireless Association, the QCWA. It's titled, A Look Back at How We Got Here, by Dave Hayes, spelled H-A-Y-E-S, Canadian amateur call sign V-E-3-J-X. This month we're reminiscing about when some of us first entered amateur radio. These memories are not to be construed as criticism of today's requirements. This is just historical information of interest, particularly to those who remember what it was like in yesterday. In Canada, our licensing system was and is different from that of the United States. In yesteryear, we had two classes, amateur and advanced amateur. Amateur class was the first license that a candidate aspired to hold. The advanced amateur class was only attainable when the operator had been licensed as an amateur class operator for a year or more. When I was first getting into amateur radio in the mid-1960s, the testing requirements were quite rigid. For the amateur class, the Canadian government exam consisted of various elements comprising an elimination series of tests. If you failed at any point, the exam was terminated, and no credits were carried over. Retesting involved starting all over again at the beginning. The advanced amateur class concentrated on modulation techniques, among other things, and included 15 word-per-minute code tests, receiving and sending. In my case, I had no trouble with the theory and the schematics in the amateur class exam or with sending Morse code. However, it took a couple of years to gain the skill of receiving 10 words per minute. That sounds awfully slow to many readers of this, I'm sure, but it was a barrier for me at the time. Back then, the code receiving tests involved copying 3 minutes of plain language text sent at the required speed of 10 or 15 words per minute using letters, numbers, and common punctuation. Only 100% copy of the text sent was acceptable. With the oral part of the exam, the radio inspector usually asks questions regarding your schematics, such as, quoting, trace the signal path through your superhet receiver, close quote. When I passed my first license, I was floating on air. Anxiously, I waited for my station ticket to arrive in the mail. I should point out that when I passed the amateur exam, I received a certificate of proficiency. With that, I could apply for my station license. I also signed VE3BRT. The station license was $2.50 per year in 1967, but would go up to $10 the following year. The amateur license gave the operator full privileges in the VHF and higher spectrum, and CW only in the high-frequency HF bands. After 6 months of operating, the amateur could apply for a 10-meter phone endorsement. The advanced amateur privileges added all modes of HF. The maximum power for both was 750 watts input, later raised to 1 kilowatt. Today, the certificate of proficiency and the state license are combined into one document that is good for life with no periodic fees. In the 60s, when I was first on the air, incentive licensing had been instituted in the United States. That included the novice license, which allowed CW operation in small HF sub-bands in the 80, 40, 15, and 10-meter bands. Actually, the novice's 10-meter assignment wasn't so little. At first, their operation was restricted to crystal control and 75-watt input. Later, they were allowed VHFs and higher power, 250 watts. The point I'm getting at is this. I loved working the novice bands. After all, I was a novice too at the time. I was always thrilled to have a station come back to me and say, "You are my first contact," or "You are my first Canadian." I always thought the novice license concept was a good one. I believe it was a non-renewable license at one time, good for a year or two only. Later, it became renewable. It needs to be said that just because our licensing requirements in yesteryear were pretty onerous compared to the current formats in our respective countries, the people who qualified under the newer regime are not lesser beings. Anyone who passes a government-approved amateur radio examination is welcome into our broad ham fraternity as an equal. Notwithstanding this, 25 years of experience as a radio amateur makes such committed individuals something special, exemplars to younger amateurs. The Quarter Century Watt Association is a fraternity of and for these special ones. Alas, the foolishness of youth. I moved away from home to another city and let my license lapse. I lost the call sign VE3BRT. Someone else, much smarter than I, picked it up and still has it to this day. Nonetheless, after I married and settled down, I re-entered the hobby and have kept my license active ever since. However, that is not to say that I have been continuously active. With many of us, amateur radio activity over the years has ebbed and flowed with whatever else was going on in our lives. However, amateur radio is such that while you may be away from it for a while, you always come back to it. At least, that is my experience. Others may make their big return after retirement, when they now have the time to indulge in pursuits that they've always desired. For them, it's like being young all over again, as they rekindle their first love. When the Quarter Century Wives Association was formed in 1947, the requirement was set that membership would be granted to those who were first licensed 25 years or more ago. It was also decided that continuous licensing was not required. In point of fact, 25 years of continuous licensing would have been an impossible requirement since amateur radio operation was terminated during World War II. All those who were founding members of QCWA would have lapsed in their activity. The requirements of the QCWA membership today are the same as at the beginning of the organization. This allows for the normal lapses in licensing that the person may have in his or her amateur radio career. However, it retains the flavor of its members having had earlier experience in the hobby. Hence the requirement that the first license held be 25 years or more ago. Of course, the secondary requirement is to be currently licensed as an amateur radio operator. Is this to say that continuous licensing has no value? Never may that be said. A person who has been continuously licensed and active has a special place in all of our hearts. In fact, the QCWA recognizes such an achievement by presenting a special certificate to those who have been continuously licensed for 50 years. This is something of which to be proud. This is something to be honored and celebrated. It is really a demonstrated quality of dependability. That notwithstanding, the QCWA appreciates the qualities and attributes of all its members. Some are outstanding operators and contesters. Others have pursued specialties within the hobby, such as QRP, digital modes, ARIS, and emergency communications, traffic handling, high-speed CW, history and preservation, antenna experimenting, equipment building, and so on. Still others have enjoyed the hobby at their own pace and in their own way. All have the experience of seeing the advancement of amateur radio through the years, including changing technology and the introduction of new modes. In my time, we have seen single sideband become the predominant HF voice mode, FM repeaters spring up around the globe, packet radio become a viable digital mode, the introduction of DSP, PSK, WinLink, Backdoor, WinMore, SDRs, DSTAR, IRLP, Echolink, APRS, and more. We have observed the transition from vacuum tubes to semiconductors to integrated circuits to software-defined circuitry. What a trip. So come join us. If you qualify, why not join us as a member of an organization dedicated to the preservation of our hobby, our history, and our experience? Become a member of the Quarter Century Wireless Association. The piece is signed DAVE3JX, Dave Haynes. Folks, here's a reminder for you with regard to the Quarter Century Wireless Association. Later on in the article, there will be an announcement, but I'll give it to you a little ahead of time right now since we're on that subject. It's the Fall CUSO Party, 1800 Zulu, 3 September to 1800 Zulu, 4 September. I'll give you listeners more specifics as I get into the contesting and the special events portion. Let's move along now to DX World. DX in radio speak means long-distance communication with stations outside of the contiguous United States. It's titled What's the Best Way to Work DX by The Numbers. The author Kelly Jones and 0VD, November 0, Victor Delta. In July's DX World headlined A View from the Other Side of the Pileup, D. Logan, W1HEO, wrote about his experience operating from Aruba. The prefix there is P4. D. mentioned several techniques he used to help manage his pileups in an effort to give a QSO to as many of the deserving as possible. One of those was to call stations quoting by the numbers. While there are many opinions as to whether this is a good idea, it can be an effective way to help reduce the number of stations calling, resulting in the DX station being able to work more people in the same amount of time. However, as simple as this may sound, there are always exceptions. Don Segetti, amateur call WD9DPK of Aruga Hills, California, dropped me an email and asked, quoting, "In your July WRO article, you stated, if the DX is asking for call area 4, then he only wants stations located in call area 4 to answer him. I live in area 6, but my call is WD9DPK. Wouldn't this cause a problem, as it is not following the request of the DX station? Should I wait until he calls for Area 9, or just do nothing and not respond?" Close quotation. Don brings up an excellent point. Since the FCC no longer requires hams to change their call if they move to a district that is not representative of their quoting number, we get into some gray area when DX stations are going by the numbers. In fact, I was in the same situation for a few years after moving to Colorado. Up until that point, I had been a 9, but always resided in 9 land. However, after moving to Colorado, I was now a 9 lander in 0 land. When I was working DX stations that were going by the numbers, I always struggled with when to call. Do I call when the DX is asking for 9s? Do I wait until he gets to 0s? Do I call when he's asking for either 9 or 0s? I have to admit, I ended up doing a combination of all three. However, it always felt a little underhanded to call as a 0, appending a slant 0 to the end of my 9 call. But oftentimes that worked to my advantage, as there were typically fewer 0s calling than 9s. That said, the goal of the DX station is usually to thin the pile in order to work more guys in the same amount of time, increasing his rate. I would stress to use your best judgment about when to call if the DX is working by the numbers. One thing is certain in all cases. If the DX is asking for 8s and you don't have an 8 in your call or don't live in the 8th area, then don't call. Please wait until one of those two criteria is met. Don Keith, amateur call N4KC of Indian Springs Villa, Alabama, also sent an email with a couple of observations regarding July's DX World. Quoting, "Kelly, I very much appreciated your comments in your World Radio Online article. Even as a casual DXer, it always amazes me that guys think they can work a station more quickly by calling out of turn or continuously sending or saying his or her call, even when the DX station is transmitting. And you are right when you say it often costs that guy the contact as well as others when he makes the entire pileup get all gunked up. I do think there should be a mention to the DX stations, though, about a few things they can do to help manage a pileup. When the DX station calls for, quoting, the station with Papa Charlie in the call, and somebody else transmits, then the DX picks up the root station anyway. It signals to everyone else that he or she will respond to others. Chaos results. The DX station should stick to his or her guns. Try to get Papa Charlie for a reasonable amount of time, letting everyone out there know he or she will not move to the next station until everyone hushes and allows him to pick him up. I love the stations that call out the interlopers. W9XXX, I call for threes, and you are not a three. If you want a contact, you will wait your turn like everyone else. You hear cheers ringing out from two up. Don makes a great point here. While every DXpeditioner has to start somewhere, it's very easy to spot the inexperience. Like Don, one of my biggest DX-related pet peeves is when the DX station asks for the Papa Charlie and ends up taking a station that doesn't have a P or C in their call. As Don states, this tells the pilot to just blatantly call regardless of who is being asked for. There are many side effects of doing this. The DX's rate will come to a grinding halt, the pilot will become unruly, and QRMers, noisemakers, will certainly make their presence known if they haven't already. And I often find myself yelling at the radio, "Don't do that!" when I hear a DX station engage in this type of operating procedure. Generally speaking, the DXpeditioner must be in control of the pilot. In the end, everybody benefits. For example, more stations will get in the log. One of my favorite stories of pile-up control comes from the days of Alan Cheshire, Victor Kilo Zero, Mike. The Penguinator, as he was affectionately known. If you were DXing in 1999 to 2000, you're sure to remember him. At the time, Macquarie Island VK0/M was very rare. Alan was stationed on the island as part of a sub-Antarctic research team, but he was an experienced DXer. When he hit the air, the pent-up demand was unbelievable, and the pileups were just as unruly. Alan's shtick was to warn the pileup that if operators did not behave, he would simply QRT, go off the air. He was not there on the DXpedition per se, and didn't have to be on the radio. He was simply providing a QSO, and likely a new one, to the deserving. Since Macquarie would be new for me, I wanted to work Alan just as badly as the rest of the world. So it was extremely frustrating for me as Alan stuck by his word and simply turned the radio off when the pileup got out of control. Of course, this toyed with the emotions of the DXers at large. Not only did we not get in the log, but he QRT'd and you didn't know when he'd be back on the air. There is something about having that carrot in front of your face, only to be taken away and nothing you could do about it. Yelling at the radio, and scores of guys who didn't follow Alan's rules didn't help, although I suppose it lowered my blood pressure. After a couple of weeks, Alan's pileups became some of the most pleasant I've ever heard. In fact, they became so well-behaved you could even have a short QSO with Alan as opposed to a simple 5-9 and run. But the bottom line was that more people made it into his log than if he had tried to duke it out with an unruly pileup. There are numerous things you can do to increase your chances of getting into the DX station's log. However, relentless calling is not, or should not be, one of them. A very good web resource is the DX Code of Conduct. That's location is www.dx-code.org/land. DXers need to comply with the DX station's requests. And always remember, the most important trick when working DX is not to call, but to listen, listen, listen. And folks, as we leave the article, on page 17 of the online version of World Radio for September 2011 is the front, what appears to be cover, apparently in full color, not here, but in full color if you were to look at it, for VK0MM Marquerie Island. It has two of those beautiful penguins that you find in that part of the world. And at the very bottom, it's very simply Alan Cheshire, ANARE 2000. That's it for this month's column. I look forward to hearing your comments, complaints, or whatever it is on your mind. If you have a story or opinion you would like to share, please send it to me at my call sign, N0VD at DXCENTRAL.com. Again, that's N0VD at DXCentral.com. I'll do my best to include it in an upcoming column. Look for me on Facebook or Twitter as well. Until the next time, see you in a pileups. Well, folks, as we read along here in World Radio Online Digest format for September 2011, might be a good time to give you Contest Corner. There are always quite a few listed on one page at least, and sometimes more than one page. However, I just tend to pick and choose. I have to admit, if I did them all, I'd probably put you to sleep. But obviously, for those of you who do chase contests in the DX, we've been talking about DX for a few minutes now with that article, let's begin with the All-Asian DX. That's 0 Zulu, 3 September, a full day, through 2359 Zulu, 4 September. It's on 160 through 10 meters single sideband. 160 meters is CW only. I mentioned to you a few minutes ago the Quarter Century Wireless Association Fall QSO Party. That's going to be 1800 Zulu September 3, a full day, to 1800 Zulu September 4. That's 160-UHF, QSO net, all modes. It's a point system. You get multipliers. If you're interested, it's on page 48. Or tune around the bands, and if you have an amateur license and can transmit on the frequency that you find them, jump right in. The Quarter Century Wireless Association Fall QSO Party, September 3 and 4. The North American Sprint, that's 0 Zulu to 0400 Zulu. That's only for 4 hours. 11 September. 80, 40, 20 meters. CW is the mode here. Continuous wave. Morse code. And one more, just for the heck of it. I'll give you Washington Salmon Run. If you're looking to catch a really good station in the sometimes elusive state of Washington in the great United States, you might want to look for the Washington Salem Run. 1600 Zulu, 17th September to 0700 Zulu, 18th September. And again, 1600 to 2359 Zulu, 18th September. Seems to be a pause there on the 18th. Maybe the fish are having trouble catching up to one of those things they jump, huh? Taking a few more tries at it. Well, if you're there to catch them going by, you'll get a good QSO. And looking further, I noticed that the North American Sprint comes up again, but this time in single sideband. That's a 4-hour run from 0 to 0400 Zulu, 18 September, 80, 40, 20 meters, single sideband. Run for the Beacon. 0100 to 0300 Zulu, 19 September. And for those of you who are into the RTTY DXing, a CQ Worldwide RTTY contest for DX, 0 Zulu 24 September to 2359 Zulu 25 September. And just as a commentary or a notation, folks, I just went through the month of September. I've been reading these magazines now for maybe 5, 6, 7 years. And time goes on when you're having fun, you know. And I see no apparent listing for a September 11, 9/11 specific type of commemoration, if you will. So if you didn't hear one, it's not because I went over it. There just haven't been any listed. There are some for that date, but that's also a Sunday, I believe, this year, September 11. So there are contests that go on all the time around the world. But no, September 11 specific commemoration. I guess perhaps my opinion, maybe that's because that was not a contest. That was a tragic, sad event and probably shouldn't even have been listed here. We're always looking for young people, young hams in the classroom. That's how they learn the quickest, by learning together as groups and experiencing the wonderful aspects of beginning with amateur or ham radio. An article here titled Superb Talks and a Surprise Guest with a Gravity Call Sign. Kids of all ages steal the show at the 2011 Dayton Youth Forum. The author, Carol Perry, amateur call WB2MGP. With 370 folks in the audience, you could hear a pin drop. You could feel the excitement. You could sense the support as the young speakers gave their presentations at the Dayton Youth Forum in May. I was delighted to have 11 young presenters this year, so we changed the format a bit and gave each one a 10-minute time slot. Even though the Dayton Amateur Radio Association, DARA, has graciously given us up to a 3-hour time slot between the presentations of the children, the giving away of the many generously donated gifts to the audience and the speakers, the surprise guests, such as an astronaut who stopped by to talk to the kids, we really ran close to the time. Ken Salhoff, N4TCP, announced to our audience that he was donating a colored dog tag souvenir to every child in the audience with their name and call sign on it. Last year, this gift was a huge hit. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is your reader, Bob Zeta, N1BLF. I'm going to just give you the list of the presenters, their name, call sign, and age, if it's noted. The article actually runs from page 8 through page 14, with a lot of text and a lot of photographs. I think it's important to make note of this for you, the listener, because if any of these young people are familiar to you, perhaps even relatives, you might want to find out what they said by having someone help you to read the material under that individual's presentation. The list of names is as follows. Liam Criswell, WD0NIZ, 14 years of age. Anna Veal, W0ANT, 10 years of age. Chris Howard, WA4YG, 15 years of age. Garrison Kuntz, KB3LEZ, 17. Ryan Harris, KD8PIR, 12. Austin Schaller, KD0FAA, 16. Amanda Lee, KD0JAY, 10. Ryan Roberts, KD0DGN, 14. The Pike Boys, KJ4AXB, AXF, and AXD, ages 17, 16, 13. Don Dubon, N6JRL, and David Calter, KB8OCP. No age listed. They were together. Also presenting were Gordon West, WB6NOA. Gordon of Costa Mesa, California, made his usual fun appearance at the youth forum. Gordo was known for his use of props and gadgets to demonstrate fun facts with people from the audience. This year, Gordo and his publisher have joined with my Radio Club of America, RCA Education Committee, to help get curriculum packages into the hands of teachers and instructors who are working with youth and ham radio. To find out if you qualify for this complimentary package, you could contact Gordy or me Discount certificates were donated to be used at the Gordon West booth at the Dayton Hamvention. And of course, Doug Wheelock, KF5BOC /gravity. The big surprise came with the visit by NASA astronaut Doug Wheelock, whose gravity call sign is KF5BOC. But he considers his real call to be NA1SS when operating from the International Space Station. In conclusion, at the top of this article by Carol Perry, her call again is WB2MGP, is a full photograph of all the individuals who participated in the Speak Forum. Each of the young speakers at the Dayton Youth Forum received an RCA Youth Achievers Award certificate and a $100 check. They were also all the recipients of an ICOM handheld radio and a packet of goodies from La Sense, a Cruz's amateur radio club. We mentioned a few minutes back the different special events. Hamfest were not part of that. I'll give you a very few here in September. New Jersey and New York Shores, the Hudson Lights, September 17th. Members of the Nutley Amateur Radio Society, called W2GLQ, will activate 6 lighthouses on the New York and New Jersey shores of the Hudson River. Operating single sideband on 12, 15, 17, 20, and 40 meters. All event information, including QSL route, can be found on QRZ.com under the call sign W2GLQ. Now, during this event, the following call signs and locations will be connected together and are able to be called by that special call sign. W2A, Statue of Liberty. It's ARLHS USA 810 and Robbins Reef, ARLHS USA 695. Special call W2B, Little Red, ARLHS USA 408. Special call W2C, Terrytown, ARLHS USA 836. W2D, Stony Point, ARLHS USA 293. And W2E, Espus, ARLHS USA 276. Heading down south, Loxahatchee, Florida, special event station K4MIA. It's operating September 10 through the 18th, 0 Zulu to 2359 Zulu. It's sponsored by the PBSE Radio Society, commemorating National POW Slant MIA, Prisoner of War, Missing in Action Recognition Day. They're operating on 21.300, 18.150, 14.265, 7185, and 3885, in various modes as well. For a change of pace, now we go west, Looking West by Bill Pasternak, called WA6ITF. Worth repeating. Tone Access and the Strange Social Order of SoCal FM. One of the most often asked questions I get is, why are there more closed repeaters on 2 meters in Southern California, that's SoCal, than there are open repeaters? The latest volume of mail tells me this well-worn issue needs to be revisited. So here's the deal. There are really very few closed repeaters in SoCal. Many users, especially newcomers to VHF, tend to equate tone access with closed. They do not comprehend, or pretend not to comprehend, that in an area where there are more hams and repeaters per square inch than anywhere else in the nation, likely the whole world, and with physical spacing between repeaters at times less than 70 miles, it is important to take steps to mitigate, if not eliminate, code channel and/or adjacent channel interference. The use of tone access is one of the tools in a frequency coordinator's and or repeater owner's toolbox to accomplish this. Yes, there are a lot of repeaters in Southern California on UHF that have a highly restricted user base and exclude all others. We'll get to that later, perhaps. Only a handful exists on 2 meters. The crowding and band saturation from 144 to 148 megahertz simply will not allow for it, because every time a new mode comes along, it demands a home, that is to say, a space on the amateur spectrum. So it's pretty hard to be private on a band where everyone is looking for a spot for his or her own ham radio interest. Actually, Southern California officially recognizes 4 district classifications of repeaters and some sub-classifications with them as well. Open, closed, private, and get ready for a mouthful. The individually owned and operated, remotely controlled, amateur-based station radio system. Here's a primer on the VHF slant UHF FM way of life since the mid-1960s, with some added observations as well. Point. The open or public access repeater is one on which any ham with a technician class or higher license can operate. Many repeaters require CTCSS tone access, but this is a technical issue and not an attempt to restrict user access. Point. The closed repeater is one where access is restricted to members of a particular group of people or club. Join the group or club, and you can use it. A closed repeater may or may not require CTCSS tone access. Closed, in this case, refers to the social nature of the individual or group sponsoring the repeater. Point. The private repeater is similar to a closed repeater, but access requires membership in a specific group or club that is not open to the general ham populace. Rather, it is restricted to those hams a system owner or licensee wants to admit. Most private repeaters are on UHF. Some private repeater owners, licensees, deny their own existence to keep the general public from knowing about them. These repeaters, unofficially called super private systems, usually require a proprietary non-standard CTCSS, or the newer digital CTCSS, for access, considered by its users classified information. As such, few super privates permit being listed in repeater directories. This makes it appear that there are far fewer UHF repeaters on the air than there really are. And of course, lest we forget the longer named one, the individually owned and operated, remotely controlled, amateur base station radio system, commonly known as remote base, is just what it says. It's an operator's personal station placed at a remote site for the use of the owner alone and or possibly a few close friends. In SoCal, it's usually on a mountaintop. Most remotes are very high power, utilize bands at 70 centimeters and above to remotely control other radios that may operate on the HF high frequency bands and VHF bands, UHF bands, and even the microwave spectrum. Many are very sophisticated to a point that the owner licensee can operate them from anywhere in the world using a computer with an internet connection or an application on a smartphone. The latest generation remote bases are fully frequency agile, run single sideband and digital modes with the ability to remotely tune a transceiver or rotate large beam antennas from anywhere the owner can achieve a cell phone or Wi-Fi connection. Talk about technology, huh? However, these are still individually owned stations, And while plentiful in Southern California, they are restricted from use by anyone other than the owner and a couple of friends. These categories of relay devices and their intrinsic user accessibility classifications were developed and agreed upon in the late 1970s by SoCal's three major bi-band frequency management groups, and have been published since then in all regional repeater directories edited by Kevin Karamanos, WD60IH, and the late Carl Pagel, N6BVU. The only modifications over the years have been for acceptance of new technologies. There have been no changes in regard to the qualification necessary for a ham user to access a repeater. Yes, it seems like a restrictive system, but it is a way of life in Southern California repeaters and has been for more than a half century. And Bill Pasternak closes with just a bit of advice. In reality, the difference between open and closed private repeaters is not tone access. Rather, it is the attitude of those who own and operate the machines and the attitude of their users. While it might not seem fair to be excluded, why would I want to go where I'm not wanted? At least out here in La La Land, there are so many repeaters that anyone with a license and a radio can easily find a repeater to call home. DEWA6ITF. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that brings me just about up to time for this month's reading of World Radio, the online edition, for September 2011 here on the Courage Handy Ham System. The editor, Richard Fisher, KI6SN. World Radio is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. If you'd like to phone them, their area code 516-681-2922. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website, we don't talk about it too much on these recordings, but it's a terrific website. It's beautifully put together and always updated daily, especially for folks that want to listen to new audio being put on there by Patrick Tice of the Courage System. The website, www.handyham.org. We always spell handyham for our purposes, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, one word, www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH geographic location is right down here near good old Cape Cod, United States of America. And guess what? I'm waiting for the next day or two for one heck of a big Hello Irene hurricane. So is the Eastern Seaboard. If you don't hear from me next month, well, whatever. 73s. Thanks a lot for listening. Bob Zeta, N1BLF.